Coming up on the DMT One-to-One Show, episode 61, on the 22nd of May 2014, an interview with Jeremy Silver, author of Digital Medieval. It's a real pleasure to welcome to the show today Jeremy Silver, as we're going to chat about your new book called Digital Medieval, The First 20 Years of Music on the Web. So hi, Jeremy, and thanks for joining me. How's it going?
Hi, Andres. Great. Good to be here.
So it's a pleasure to have you. And Jeremy, as a means of introduction for listeners of the show that haven't heard about Jeremy before, he has been involved in the music industry for the past 20 years, starting at 1992 at Virgin Records as Director of Media Affairs, then becoming Vice President of New Media, getting the first taste of the internet, then moving on to shape EMI's global digital strategy. You also worked at a music startup called Uplister for a time during the dot-com boom and bust of the early 2000s. You were the CEO of the Featured Artist Coalition for a time, and also the CEO of Sibelius Software, and you're currently Executive Chairman at Symmetric and Shared Music Glue. So lots of stuff going on here, Jeremy, and it's great talking to you today. First of all, we're going to talk about the title of the book, Digital Medieval. What spurred you to write the book, and where does the title come from?
So I decided that it was worth trying to document all the extraordinary things that happened in this period of 20 years. It feels like 20 years of the web sounds like an immense amount of time, and yet in a way, you know, the amount of things that have gone on in that period are far larger and far more than anyone could have imagined, I guess. And but at the same time, I have that strong feeling that in lots of ways, we're just at the beginning of all of this.
Right.
And so the medieval idea was really all about that sense of it being, you know, we're still in the dark ages, we're still feeling our way. And actually, of course, the medieval period was a period of great innovation, as well as one of chaos and strife, and that seemed in lots of ways to sum up the kind of what we've experienced with music on the web. And there was a lot of ways in which the old rules and the simple ways in which things had worked before, and the clarity of the church governing the west of Europe was all disintegrating.
Right.
And the rules were all changing. And actually, when you think about, you know, music on the web, all the rules have changed all the time, and in lots of ways, not just around music, actually more broadly as well, there's that feeling that actually people are making up new ways of doing business all the time now.
Yeah.
And still doing that.
Yeah, of course. And so tell us a little bit about the companies that you feel are the center of this digital medieval period, and how they are shaping the reality that we live in.
Well, I think that, you know, when you the obvious big players for us today have become giants in the landscape. And really, when you think about the role that Google and Facebook and Amazon and Apple between them play, and I would say those four companies, there are others as well, Twitter and Yahoo and so on. But I think if we just look at those four companies, they really are dominating the landscape. They're influencing the ways in which people are doing business. They're creating platforms around which whole ecosystems of businesses are being built. And again, without wanting to push the medieval metaphor too far, it does strike me that there's a really interesting analogy there, where these the business models of these companies are all about trying to pull consumers in, all about, if you like, a walled garden approach.
Right.
Which is really about making sure that once we're involved on their particular platform, that it becomes increasingly attractive to stay there and more difficult to leave.
Yeah.
and that is so, you know, what starts off as a walled garden eventually becomes more like a city state.
Sure.
And you know, I think, you know, with Amazon and with Apple in particular, we're kind of really increasingly seeing ourselves drawn into being, you know, an Apple kind of a person or an Amazon kind of person. And actually, it becomes more and more difficult to be agnostic.
And I was looking at sort of the companies that, of course, are at the core of this revolution in the book. And one thing that struck me is the fact that a lot of them, or all of them actually, are Western in origin. So on a globalized playing field, how do you see countries like China and India coming onto the internet with the Wagnerians now? How do you see India and China shape how these companies, for example, are going to operate? And will we see new players coming from developing countries that might disrupt this pattern that we're seeing right now in the West?
Well, I think certainly in China, there are companies like Weibei and like Tencent that are analogous to these giants in the West. And because of the political situation and because of the sort of technological great wall, firewall of China that's been set up, in some respects, there is a different kind of environment in China.
Yeah.
But equally, we still are seeing some big giant players who are pulling in very large numbers of consumers and then creating environments in which smaller businesses actually work, in a kind of dependent relationship with those large companies.
Absolutely.
And I think that's the thing that's interesting about it. When you think about it from a music point of view, and then you look at what's going on in the landscape as a whole, what you kind of start to see is the way in which actually artists and then independent labels and then the majors represent a kind of structure and a set of relationships, which is not dissimilar to what we then see writ large in the broader landscape of startup companies and big tech players.
Yeah, absolutely. And so India actually is a very different country than China, put them together. But of course, India is different in the sense that with over a billion people, it doesn't have anywhere near the technological infrastructure that China has to produce those large companies. And so actually companies like Google are doing very well there. And so maybe we're going to see a homogenization a little bit of the landscape on that front, in spite of there being some local companies that are trying to make some inroads in the industry. And I wanted to go a little bit back on the history, sort of rewind the clock a little bit and talk about your start at Virgin. So Virgin was where you first sort of got your tastes of the internet and how things were working on that front. So tell us a little bit about when you realized that the web was going to be a thing and what you did at Virgin about it.
Oh, well, I mean, the internet was there for quite a long time before the web came along, of course. And, the very beginning of the web, actually, there was very little that you could go and see. There was many websites. So, and actually, I mean, in that, so true for a lot of people. What we're finding is that the people made promotional activities. So the reason why you built a website was not because you thought that lots of people were going to come to the website or download the music or engage with the bands. The reason why people would come to these websites is because basically they were journalists and news reporters who were writing about this cool stuff that was going on, and that actually the value for the artist or for the label was in the promotional coverage that it got in the old media, not the value of the new media itself. So, that's changed hugely in some respects.
Yeah.
But in other ways, interestingly, it's still there in as much as people still want to glom onto the latest thing. They still want to use, whether it's the new virtual reality kind of idea or whether it's high definition audio or whether it's, 3D printing or whatever it might be. The current thing is still something that artists like to be associated with because it generates publicity.
Yeah.
So there is an interesting kind of relationship there.
Yeah, absolutely. So I guess, the way that you justified spending a budget on being online at the beginning was for that PR effect, right?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah. Nobody thought that we were going there because we were going to create a whole new audience. Everyone thought that was completely insane. And the idea that people would watch anything on the internet rather than watching it on TV was completely nuts, obviously. Whereas, where we are now is completely the other way around.
Exactly. And so the industry, of course, has experienced a number of failures over, late 90s, early 2000s, when it came to dealing with how the landscape was evolving. One of the most glaring ones, but actually one of the least known, I think, as a popular culture kind of thing, is a failure of SDMI, the Secure Digital Music Initiative. So can you explain what SDMI was and why that failure was significant for the industry?
SDMI was a grand plan that in lots of ways kind of encapsulated all the ideals of the major labels and the music executives running them at the time. The idea was to engage on a grand scale all of the consumer electronics companies, the IT companies, the infrastructure companies, all together in an agreement around an architecture that would essentially create a regulated and controlled version of the internet,
right,
across which music could flow in a controlled fashion and value could be captured. And actually, you know, in lots of ways, its aspiration and its scale of vision was extraordinary and has never really been attempted to be repeated. And you know, I think it's something that in years afterwards, people have kind of derided it and said it was crazy and said all these guys were smoking crack. But actually, you know, and I think they probably were, to be honest, because they had, I think there was such a failure to understand the fact that even while they were sitting around in high quality conference halls, in glamorous venues, in different countries around the world, the MP3 horses had already bolted and were charging off across the plain, you know. So yeah. it was a great idea and had a great vision, and I think that there are still executives out there who would love to see that become obtainable, and I think some of the attempts at legislation that we've seen have continued in that same vein, which is all about, you know, attempting to control and centralize the way in which music and ultimately all content gets distributed across the web.
And it's interesting to talk about you know, an initiative that failed, that was trying to bring the industry together and come up with a few resolutions around the way things were being done online. And but one of the problems you highlight is the fact that the industry is always trying to renovate old structures rather than innovating entire new processes. So do you think that's the reason why SDMI failed, and also the reason why a project that makes complete sense from you know, a theoretical and rational point of view, like the Global Repertoire Database, it seems to be hitting some roadblocks and it's not able to move forward at the moment?
Well, I think when you look at something like SDMI, the lessons that you can learn from a project like that were all about the alignment or ultimately the non-alignment of business models. So the fact was that the music industry believed that it could in some way or other persuade all of these other very large industry sectors that they could formulate around a common business model that would be in all of their interests.
Yeah.
And in the end, it became pretty apparent that that simply wasn't the case. And that, you know, that when you and when you start to add the, you know, mobile dimension to into it, which at the time was much smaller, but has now obviously become very dominant, that became even more apparent and even more obvious. And but there were the seeds in there of things that have worked. So if you look today at the way in which Spotify and Deezer and Beats have actually grown their own market share very quickly, it's by particularly by doing deals with telcos, yeah, and by bundling their product inside mobile operators. And essentially what they've done in those sorts of deals is found a way of aligning their business models in such a way that the both parties were motivated to participate. And obviously there's been a bunch of false starts along the way, and SDMI was the first grandest of those, but then we saw, you know, Nokia Comes With Music was another attempt to try and do that. And finally, it looks as if this new sort of model, we'll see, but it looks like it might be working for these guys. But mind you, you know, we've still got some way to go.
Yeah, sure. And talking about the way in which rights were handled for the most part of the 2000s and also through to today, even though the situation is improving considerably, when you talk about the experience with Uplister, it's painfully obvious what the problems were and still are to a certain extent within the industry when it comes to startups that want to license music for use in a new way, essentially. So, you know, it was very obvious how much a balance when you were trying to get a company off the ground. You know, the company's idea, of course, and the staff were super important in getting the funding, but then the market conditions and the willingness of investors to gamble on that idea was also equally important. And, of course, the dot-com bust was a real problem for all startups that had good ideas but weren't able to get further funding to keep them going. Plus, the location of the startup is paramount. You know, of course, being in Silicon Valley or today here in London or Berlin and in some of the hubs of startups is definitely helpful. And also, finally, and most importantly for a music startup, is the conditions of licensing and what kind of license the company needs and whether rights holders were willing to negotiate reasonable conditions. And so, you know, today things seem to have changed a lot, and record labels realize that it's no longer a case of making a hit and run with a startup and getting as much advance as possible and then, or as much equity as possible and then running with it. But still, there are still issues when it comes to small startups trying to license music that are to do with just the generic licensing landscape for music. So how do you see that evolve? And what kind of lessons can we learn from, you know, from your Uplister experience that are still sort of worrying problems that are happening today?
I think the thing that's interesting is that the kind of circumstances under which music are licensed today in the industry have evolved to this point because the subdivision of rights historically has always really served the industry well.
Yeah.
So it's the reason why there are so many different permutations of rights and so many different elements that have to be put together in order to get a complete license in order to run a service, particularly the publishing and the recording rights together. Is very much a matter of history and of value. But actually today, it almost is beginning to look as if it might actually mitigate against that value. In other words, that it's now so painful and so complex still to license music that actually that may actually work against the people who own the content because licensing becomes too difficult. So, you know, the obvious example of that is the lack of Pandora's inability to establish itself in Europe because of the complexity of trying to establish licenses in 30 different territories in Europe. Having said that, I do think that we're seeing the majors being more receptive to new models, not simply putting roadblocks in the way of something they've never seen before, but taking a genuine and active interest in trying to understand how another model might work and how people might find value in music again. And clearly, we need to do that, and we've got to keep on doing that. And that openness to experiment has to continue to grow because we're still, I think, have not necessarily reached the end game here. You know, we've moved from the download model to the streaming model. Everybody's now convinced that streaming is where it's at and downloading isn't. And yet, at the same time, we all understand that there is immense complexity in the streaming model, particularly based on subscriptions, that the artist side of things is very unclear, that the way in which labels divide up the royalty streams and so on is not easy to understand. And the complexity of online and offline plays, of cached, non-cached, multiple streams, the variation in the effective pricing, the numbers of people subscribing in any one accounting period is so complex that very few people have really got their heads around what that actually means, let alone how to really monetize it properly. So I think that we will see new models for selling music, that we're not done yet, and that we will have to keep circling around and keep working this out. And so the licensing has to get more flexible and more friction-free than it is, not less so.
Yeah. Absolutely. You know, there's loads of interesting episodes that are, you know, narrated in the book, so definitely worth checking it out and reading it all. But one of the things that I found particularly fascinating was your account of the FAC meeting at Air Studios, and a particularly telling and fascinating episode around the inner working of the artist community. So can you tell us a little bit about that, and also about how you feel the artist community's role within negotiations and their weight is changing across the industry?
Well, as the shift in revenues has moved away from recording and towards live from an artist's point of view, then campaigns have become more and more centered around the artist. And yet, at the same time, artists still don't really feel as empowered as you would have thought that change would have created. And there are lots of reasons for that, and there are lots of different flavors. I mean, that particular occasion that you mentioned earlier was at the height of the debate around file sharing when the Digital Economy Act was being pushed through Parliament in the UK. And the artist community was really divided. So there were those people who felt really, really strongly that their rights needed to be protected, that online piracy was an outrage, was a betrayal, was something that had to be stopped at any cost, and that there should be no barriers to imposing penalties on consumers and on fans who file shared in that way. And there were equally artists who felt passionately the opposite, that actually it was the technology that was enabling it, that whatever you tried to do, you couldn't really stop it, that you shouldn't be penalizing the fans, you should be penalizing the infrastructure operators or the technology operators, but not the fans themselves. And there was this real tension and real passion, because the one thing that you always get from artists is emotion and passion that comes into these arguments, right? And very often that's incredibly difficult to handle and to manage, because it clouds all the issues. And so we had, you know, Lily Allen spilling wine and staggering around the room, smoking and in one minute laughing and the next minute in tears as this debate went on. And we had Billy Bragg standing on a chair, brandishing his magic markers and his felt tip pens, trying to draw pictures on a whiteboard. It was just a crazy scene. And I was bizarrely found myself in the middle of this, trying to manage these guys. And there was, you know, Nick Mason from Pink Floyd sitting there like a kind of wise sage, and no one could tell what he was thinking at all. And Ed O'Brien from Radiohead kind of stroking his beard and sort of thinking, yeah, this is interesting, but I don't know what I think. David Arnold, you know, who did the Bond movies, was like stomping his feet, furious that this was going on. And there was Crispin, who is from the Long Pigs, Crispin Hall, who just stomped out and said, you guys are all insane, I'm not even going to take part in this anymore. And it was surreal. You know, George Michael apparently was in the mastering suite upstairs and had a runner going up and down to try and find out what was going on, because this thing was so crazy. And I didn't know how we were going to get to an end. The amazing thing was, though, that actually, when you put a bunch of artists together in a room like that, the last thing they actually want to do is fight. So what happened was that this kind of compromise came about, and the debate was really about, well, what do you do, or what sort of remedies are there, and should you cut off people's internet access, or could you, you know, what else can you do? And in the end, they came out with this idea of that you could slow someone's connection, you could squeeze the pipe down, so they could still do their email, and they could still get online, and they could even maybe download, but it'd be incredibly slow, and that would be a good punishment for them. And that was the compromise we came out with, and everyone was just hysterically happy that we'd managed to reach this compromise as a result.
That's funny. And you know, you touch upon copyright law in the book and the potential need to review it both in the EU and the US. So in that sense, what do you think right now are the most glaring problems with the current systems? And I know, you know, for example, we've seen some calls from the HADOPI agency in France to review the DMCA style process, and I know the same things are being talked about in the States. What do you think are the most glaring problems with the copyright law in both these regions that should be addressed, really?
Well, I the thing is that there are the practical realities of what technology has done, which it's very, very hard to undo. And fundamentally, what technology has done has made it impossible to control the reproduction of music or of any other digital content. You can suppress it, you can make it more difficult, but you cannot control it. The reality is, if you and I can hear each other through a digital device, then we can record that output. And that's the bottom line, and you ain't going to change that. So from a very idealistic point of view, I think one has to ask the question, if you have a body of law that is based on the ability to control the reproduction of a work, and you have a reality in the real world that says, actually, you can't control it, then there is something fundamentally wrong with that law that needs to be addressed. And it's as simple as that, and it's also as enormous and as categorically difficult as that. And so from time to time, I've engaged to a greater or lesser degree in the debates around this and attempting to try and help policy development in a way that would deal practically with what we face here. But I have to confess that for the most part, when you really sit down and talk with politicians about this topic, they all want to run a mile. Of all the topics, of all the possible vote-winning topics that a politician might want to engage in, this is not one of them. And so I am not a great optimist about the chances of our really realistically reforming copyright in such a way, and constructively, that it could actually provide a new framework for providing value back to artists and creators. And yet I think ultimately that's what we will have to get to. And so That's another reason why we might now be in the digital medieval period, and maybe at some point in the digital renaissance that we'll get to that kind of copyright reform. But at the moment, I think it is so thorny an issue, and the lobbying is so hard from the entertainment industry, understandably, but at the same time in a way that doesn't help move the agenda forward. So I think there's a lot of challenges still to go there.
Absolutely, and I think it's testament of that fact that, you know, last year I was interviewing a prominent member of the administration in the States, and I was prepped by four people who were very, very concerned about wording when it came to copyright review and reform and all that kind of stuff. So it definitely shows you the concern around.
Yes. I mean, even today, actually, you know, right now in the UK, we're looking at the reform of some of the revisions around private copying,
yeah.
which frankly, private copying is legal in the US, but it has never been legal in the UK, even though every single person who has a digital device copies privately on a daily basis. Trying to agree what the wording of the law will be in order to accommodate that simple reform, which it doesn't necessarily change anything, but, you know, because of this, you know, heavily legalistic view that everyone takes, and the heavy lobbying that goes through it, and this obsession with the precedents that may be set, all for very understandable reasons.
Yeah.
It just makes it very hard to see how things will move forward constructively.
Yeah. And looking at the way in which the digital medieval period, as you describe it in the book, affects consumers, so what do you think is consumers' perception right now? Because in a sense, I think, for the most part, consumers feel fairly free now within different ecosystems, and they only find that they're locked in when they try to do something that is not in their ordinary routine, I guess. So how do you think that's going to progress, and are consumers going to come to a halt when they realize that some things just can't happen and that is really locking them into specific systems?
Yeah, I think there's a funny kind of naivety that exists amongst consumers, and maybe it's willful naivety, I don't know, but certainly that, you know, the fact is that we are in a data-driven environment now, where the value of consumers is all about the data that they contribute back to the businesses that they transact with, and mostly that is not on the surface, and mostly in our contractual relations with Google or with Facebook or with Amazon, what we think we're doing and what we're actually doing in terms of a business transaction are not necessarily the same thing at all. So that's not so much about the direct purchase of something. It's more about our activity, our transaction, our engagement with content within the platforms that those are operated by those guys.
Yeah.
And obviously there's a much broader question here about personal privacy and personal data and the accumulation of that data to sell us things back that we want, or to sell advertising to us, or whatever. And we could get into that whole debate. But I think, you know, that is an area of considerable concern, which is only going to get worse as time goes by, which consumers, on the whole, are always willing to run blindly into, as long as services are offered for free.
Yeah.
I mean, it is quite incredible that we have one of the largest companies in the world in Google, with one of the biggest profit lines in the world. And, you know, fundamentally, we all think that Google runs something for free.
Yeah,
but clearly, you know, that is not what the business model is, and that is not what we're doing there. We are adding value on a daily basis every single time we do a search. So I think that sits there as an enormous kind of thicket of complexity that we're going to get into. But at the same time, actually, for music consumers and music fans right now, we have incredible diversity. We have an amazing array of different sorts of ways of consuming music and ways of engaging with our artists, and whether it's on the live side or whether it's on the recorded side or whether it's through streaming or whether it's through downloads or whether it's through community. And I think it's really rich and it's really exciting.
Yeah.
I just want to see that continue to grow, because I think there's all kinds of cool stuff that's going to happen.
Exactly. And going on the other end of the spectrum, when we're looking at crowdfunded and the direct-to-fan initiatives, we've seen a big growth of those companies. You know, you're on the chair on Music Glue, and also, you know, we've seen the growth of Pledge Music and, of course, Kickstarter, but not so much on the music front. And one question that I've been asking myself, and I think you also address in the book, is a question around scale. So We're seeing these services grow. They're still a very small portion of the recorded music industry's revenues, for example. Do you feel like the services have enough of a runway to become, and the consumers are interested enough in music to shift en masse to crowdfunded or direct-to-consumer offerings, or do they have a limited scope?
Well, I think, I mean, there are two different things, right? So I mean, the whole crowdfunding model is doesn't necessarily have to relate to direct-to-fan. It's a part of the direct-to-fan story. Yeah. So, I mean, thinking about crowdfunding, I think the thing that's exciting about that is the way in which it drives creativity right into the very act of selling. So, you know, why does Kickstarter excite so many people? Why does Pledge Music work? It's not just because of the flavor of the music or the product. It's because of the whole package. It's because of the personality, the crazy zaniness of whatever it is that's being offered as a reward, the color of the t-shirt, the logo, the fact that you get your name in the packaging. All of these things are different triggers that encourage people to purchase. And actually, in terms of consumer marketing, that's much more creative and much more engaging and much more about understanding that this is a conversation and a relationship that's starting than any of the conventional marketing that we've seen. And I think the thing that's really exciting about crowdfunding is the fact that you create a community in the process which doesn't then go away, but is actually vested in, interested in you, and continues to go with you and that you can come back to. And that seems to me to be the thing that is really at the very heart of it. And it's at the heart of D2C as well. But in lots of ways, crowdfunding represents the kind of the apotheosis of that, like the best possible version of that, because now you've got not just a direct-to-fan communication, but actually you've got a conversation going on. Yeah. And you're getting a response and you're getting an interaction, and that is where it's going to go. That seems to me to be such an attractive model, and it's what we've always felt. I think when we get engaged with a band or an artist, where we get seduced by that music, we all individually feel that we've got some personal relationship with the artist. It's just that historically we never did, whereas now we really can. So then I think the question is. Is, and you asked this question, is it just going to be a niche, or can that actually scale out more broadly? And that, I think, is the question that remains to be seen. Because at the end of the day, it will come down to the skills of folks to be able to sustain that engagement. But also there's a degree to which the more artists who are doing that, the less novel it becomes, the more extreme the enticements have to become. And it's hard to know whether that can be exhausted or whether that remains endlessly inventive. Yeah. I mean, I certainly, if you go and spend time on Kickstarter and you start browsing around, it does start to feel more and more like a kind of exotic bazaar, like you're in some sort of like Turkish souk, where a digital souk where you kind of have all these different blandishments. But after a while, maybe they all start to seem the same, because actually, so that's, I think that's the question that's still an unknown. I don't know where that goes, but I think that the development of that relationship and the two-way conversation between fans and artists, that is going to grow and grow for sure.
And bringing the interview to a full circle, I wanted to ask you about, we've been talking about the middle ages of digital and of digital music especially. And so, of course, looking at the historic metaphor, we can hopefully look forward to an era of enlightenment, but God knows when that's going to come. So I wanted to ask you, if that was to come around for you, what would it look like and what would be its main drivers?
Well, I think, hopefully we can see some glimmers of it. So I think that if you take the way in which high definition audio, high definition video, holographic projections, high granularity, high definition of transmission of content is going to get more and more exciting. And, we are going to get to the place where every single performance by every single artist that happens live is going to be available online for you to stream into your home as a full-blown 3D experience in your living room if you want it. And, obviously that will be really expensive to start off with, but I'm sure it'll get cheaper as time goes by. I think that driver for more and more immersive, more and more realistic, more and more all-encompassing experiences will be the thing that gives life to our content and life to our artists progressively. And in order to do that, we will have to simplify licensing, and I think we will. I think we will see, as time goes by, the pressure to bring the rights together into bundles that are more easily managed and that will allow people to make licenses more quickly, more spontaneously, and across different sorts territorial restrictions will start to become less important and so on. I think all of that are the things that we need to see in order to have this incredible kind of sense of all music in the flesh anywhere through the kind of virtual reality. And I wrote about some of that in the book, and it's interesting to see that since then Facebook acquired the rights to this virtual reality company. Yeah. There's obviously something that's moving in that direction, so we'll see.
You can imagine in 5 years' time we're going to be doing this show in front of a live virtual audience with our Oculus Rifts on our heads, and it's all going to be very exciting.
Well, hopefully the Oculus Rift visor will have sort of shrunk to something that will become invisible, so we won't have to all go around looking like these super freaks, but you know.
Exactly. Yeah. Or be in our homes looking like super freaks to everybody else around us. And Jeremy, it was an absolute pleasure having you on. Once again, the book is Digital Medieval, and you can find it on Amazon. Is it available internationally, I would assume?
On Amazon, on iTunes, on Music Glue.
Awesome. And of course, just type Digital Medieval or Jeremy Silver on one of those services and you'll find it. You can also find a link to it in the recommended tab on Digital Music Trends, and there's a little Amazon store there and you'll find the link straight to the Kindle edition. It's also, is it digital only at the moment?
No, you can buy a paperback.
Oh, wow, awesome.
A physical thing and make notes.
Amazing. That's awesome. So fantastic. You can go and get that. I actually really like to have industry books in paper, which is kind of weird. I'm pretty happy to have fiction books on a Kindle, but if it's a sort of industry thing, I like to have them on paper because then I can reference back and make notes and all that kind of stuff. It makes it a lot more exciting. And also it looks nice on the bookshelf. You know, you have a nice digital music section, which... I love to have old school like that. Jeremy, once again, thanks so much. Jeremy, you can find Jeremy on JeremySone on Twitter, his handle, and anywhere else that people should look for you?
MediaClarity.com.
Perfect. So that's MediaClarity.com. Thanks so much.
If you enjoyed watching or listening to the show and would like to find more, head on to DigitalMusicTrends.com.